Tonight, we're going to start a new study on the book of Proverbs. If you would turn there, let's just read a few verses to sort of get our feet wet. All I'm going to do tonight, however, is to just, like I said, give you an introduction, some things to think about as we then proceed, and we're not going to be going all that fast. We're not going to be going verse by verse necessarily, but we'll just be talking about some of the themes of the book. We're in Proverbs just chapter 1 tonight. Let me read the first 6 verses. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice and judgment, and equity. I'm having to get used to my Bible again. What was lost has now been found, so I've got my Bible back. I don't have my eyes back yet, able to read it. To give subtlety to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels. To understand a proverb and the interpretation, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. Okay, well, let's get started. I want to use mainly a PowerPoint tonight to just put some things up here on the wall. And Charles, next in previous, what a hit. Okay, we'll see if I can figure this thing out. We're just going to look at some basic concepts to the book of Proverbs to begin with tonight. And one of the first questions is, what is a proverb? Anybody want to take a stab at it? How would you define a proverb, Joe? Wise old sayings. That's pretty good. Anybody got another? Can you improve on that? Okay, a short or a pithy statement that expresses a truth or a fact, something like that. Have you ever heard the expression, something is proverbially true? What do we mean? A truism. Well, yeah, okay, we're going to get to that in a minute. Let me give you my, it's a pithy. Yeah, anybody know what pithy means? What is pith? If you have a stalk of a weed, pith is the fiber inside. It's the stuff of the stalk that's made. So when we say that something is pithy, we mean it's condensed down to its substance. It's not the juicy part, it's the pithy part. So it's a pithy, pointed, perceptive precept promoting wisdom. Say that real fast 10 times. It's pithy. It's condensed. It's encapsulated. Okay? It's pointed. What would you mean by that? And by the way, this is my definition. I point you in a specific direction. It's meant to give direction to you. It is perceptive. A perceptive precept. I guess that's a redundancy. A rule, something of that nature, promoting wisdom. And that brings me to my next question. What is wisdom? Let me hear some of your definitions. How would you describe wisdom? We have that mentioned here in our text, that the idea of this in verse 3 is to receive the instruction of wisdom. Don't be bashful, David. The skill in applying knowledge. Now that's interesting. The skill to apply knowledge. Now what's the difference then between wisdom and knowledge? Knowledge is knowledge of the facts. Like I can understand what a hammer is used for and how a hammer is made, but the carpenter is skillful in wielding the hammer. He's able to take what he knows and do something with it. One of the illustration that always comes to my mind in thinking about wisdom is happened in Timco, which was a defense plant outside of Greenville, Texas. When I was a kid growing up, they told this story. They were building one of these buildings, and they had this huge generator of some sort, this huge heavy thing that they had the walls up to the building. There was no roof on it yet, so they used a crane to lower this huge piece of equipment down to the floor, and they wasn't sure exactly where they're going to put it, so they put it on some jacks. They had jacks around the perimeter of the thing. And anyway, later on they put the roof on, and then they decided, okay, we want to go ahead and let this thing down to the floor, but they got to figuring out, how do we get the jacks out from under it? You know, you can jack it up a little higher and put something under there, but then you can't get that out. How do you get the jacks out from under it? There was an old black janitor that worked there in the plant. And he said, they brought in engineers from all over the country trying to figure out, how do we get this thing on the floor? And this black janitor said, when you give up, I'll tell you how to do it. And finally, they gave up. And they went to him, and they said, well, how do we do it? He said, well, you jack it up, you go down here to the ice house and get you some blocks of ice and set around the base of the perimeter. Let the jacks down on the ice. Let it fall down on the ice. Get your jacks out from under it. And as that ice melts, it'll settle right down to the floor. That's what they did, and it worked. Now that was a, now notice, he never had been to college, never had been to school, but he knew ice. In other words, wisdom is the ability to skillfully employ what you know. Let me give you my definition here, and I'm having trouble reading the little one up there. It's the skillful application of knowledge. And what that boils down to, it's the ability to discern what is the right course of action in a given situation. And the Proverbs in the book of Proverbs are like that. It's telling you what you need to do in a specific circumstance or in a specific situation. Here's the wise course of action. All right, let's go a little further. What is the prerequisite for wisdom? I'm giving you the answer as we look. It is the fear of God. Notice that that pops up here in chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. As I would say, the prerequisite, you know what a prerequisite is. You got to have algebra 1 before you take algebra 2. It's what you got to know before you can take the main course, okay? So what do you have to have in order to learn this thing called wisdom? And number one, you have to have the fear of God. That not only is said here, but also later on in chapter 9 and verse 10, the same thing is repeated. So what does that mean? Well, it means that there is a certain mindset that if you're really going to understand true knowledge, and by that, spiritual principles, there's a certain mindset that you have to have, or a paradigm, I call it here, a worldview that involves what I call here respecting, or acknowledging, respecting, obeying, and worshiping the God of the Bible. If you would be made wise in the biblical sense, then this is absolutely essential. Now let me stop and ask you why that's so. Now do you understand by fear of God, I'm not talking about being scared of God. Now I'm talking about being scared to disobey Him. But I'm not talking, I always use the illustration that I never was scared of my father, but I did fear Him. I feared disobeying Him because I knew what was coming. And so there's a sense in which we have a healthy respect of God. So it's not fear in the sense that, oh me, it's sort of like some monster coming along that we run from. But it is a respect because we know, Tom Smith, one time he was talking about, we were talking about this very concept. And he said, if you open a door and somebody is standing there with a double barrel shotgun aimed right at your head, what do you do? Well, you would jump back, wouldn't you? The person who does not react like that, if you open the door and the person's there with a double barrel shotgun and you don't react, you don't know much about shotguns. Because the person who knows what a shotgun can do is going to react that way. You respect it. You have a healthy fear of what the gun can do. In the same sense, we have a healthy fear of what God can do. And so we stand in awe of Him. Sometimes the idea of reverence enters into the fear of God. So let me stop and ask that question again. Why is that essential for the understanding of true biblical wisdom? Robert, give it a shot. Okay, He's the source of this thing. So you're on a fool's errand. You're seeking wisdom and you're turning your back on the source of that wisdom. Roscoe?
But He's the one that created all things, wrote the rules.
That's right.
He knows
that really is truly to know all things, isn't it? Most complicated thing you can think of. Worse than nuclear physics by far. Yeah. I got you. And it's sort of like saying this, that God is the one who designed us, made us, and the manufacturer typically has the rule book. In other words, here is the book that comes along with the piece of equipment that tells you how it's supposed to operate, what you got to do to maintain it. And in the same sense, the God who formed us and made us has given us the rule book, what we need to have if we're going to keep going, if we're going to be maintained, that's what we've got to have. Now, that's okay. Some good thoughts here. Let's go on a little further. What a proverb is not. And sometimes it's just as important. In fact, in my experience, it is extremely important to realize what a proverb is not. It is not a promise without exception. And that is the difference between a proverb and a promise. A proverb is proverbially true. A promise of God is always true, without exception. But a proverb may have some exceptions. Let me give you an example. The one out of Proverbs 20, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he shall not depart from it. Y'all have heard that. Is that always universally true? No. Is it usually true? Yes. Is it generally true? In other words, that would be the case most of the time. And Proverbs are like that. They're not telling you something that never, ever has an exception. Again, to quote Tom Smith, in one of our conversations, I remember him saying that 95% of life is covered by the book of Proverbs. And he said the other 5% is covered by the book of Job. Because in Job's case, there's the problem of the exceptions when Proverbs break down. They're not always true. And the problem with Job's three friends is they're treating what they think as a proverb as if it were a promise that the outcome is always guaranteed. And therefore, Job, if you're suffering, it must be because you didn't follow the rule book here. And Job, of course, is insisting all along, I did follow the rule book and I'm suffering. Something's broken down somewhere. They're really all thinking the same way. But they're saying this means you're a sinner, and Job's saying, no, wait a minute, I know better than that. Something's gone wrong in the computer in the sky here. I'm getting a bill when I should have a credit. So be very careful there. I got into a very heated argument with a lady many, many years ago, and she just took that proverb as God's guarantee that He was going to save her children, that she, if she just did a decent job rearing her children. And, oh, my, the disaster that home became. One child hung himself. The older boy that was a friend of mine took off as far as he could get, as quickly as he could get away from there. It was just a horrible home situation. And yet, this lady is insisting that if I raise them under the sound of the gospel and so forth, that guarantees they're going to be saved. Well, that's just not the point of a proverb. If it is, we need to be studying it all the time. It's more important than any other part of the Bible, if that's true, because it has more promises, more covenants in it, anywhere else you're going to find in Scripture. But that's not how a proverb works. And yet, I want you to look at the second half of this. It's not a proverb, a promise without exceptions, but it is a principle that is generally true to life. Right? If I say, plant your seed in the spring and you'll have a harvest in the fall. That's generally true. But it is not without exception. It doesn't always occur. And that brings me to this. While a proverb does not guarantee a universal outcome, it does state a universal duty. Now let that sink in. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. That is not always how it comes out, but it is always what I am supposed to do as a parent, whether or not it turns out that way or not. You see the difference? So plant your seed in the spring and you'll have a harvest in the fall is not always true. There may be reasons why you have a crop failure, but one thing is true. The fellow who reaps in the fall is the fellow that planted in the spring. So on one hand, there is a universal side to this proverb. It is always showing us what the wise course of action is as far as what we should follow. That much is universal. Let's go a little further. Well, let's talk about the authorship of Proverbs. This might seem to be the simplest thing we have here. Notice that we have in the very first verse, of the first chapter, it is called the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. Nails it down pretty well. In Hebrew, Solomon's name is sort of pronounced Shlomo. And if you were to leave off the O, what would you have? Shalom. And what does that sound like to you? Shalom. And what does shalom mean? Peace. Well, Solomon's name means peaceful. Solomon, in his reign, you remember David's reign lasted, Saul's reign lasted for 40 years. David's reign lasted for 40 years. So did Solomon's. Solomon got to reap the benefit of his father being a man of war. Solomon, on the other hand, was a man of peace, and he was able to reign in a time of great, great prosperity when the nations around Israel had been subjugated by the wars of his father. Notice we have again in Proverbs chapter 10, verse 1, the Proverbs of Solomon is what it is named. Let's remember Solomon's birth. Who was his mommy? Bathsheba. Recall that David committed adultery with Bathsheba, tried to cover it up by murdering Uriah the Hittite, her husband, and yet was found out. God sent the prophet Nathan to expose him. And the child that was born to her and to them, you remember, died. But then, after Nathan says, "You shall not die," that God has put away your sin, she conceives again and gives birth to Solomon. Does anybody remember the other name God gave to Solomon? Jedediah, meaning? See, you only got one half there. You could have got a clean sweep. Jedediah means beloved. And that is very noteworthy in the fact that, remember, the previous child born to them died as a consequence of their sin. And so this child, the second child, was born and called by God Jedediah, Nathan said, in that he is beloved of God, showing how God had indeed given David and put away his sin. So this becomes the kingly line. He will succeed David on the throne. Then notice Solomon's dream in 1 Kings. Y'all know the story? Let's go. 1 Kings. And you're going to be surprised where he had this dream. He is at the tabernacle, and I might say it's the Arkless tabernacle, because remember, at this point in time, David had brought the tabernacle to a tent in Jerusalem where he was reigning. The tabernacle was about 6 miles away, set up. The priests were ministering there, but there was no ark inside the tabernacle. But nevertheless, here in 1 Kings chapter 3, in verse 5, we read, in Gibeon. Have y'all heard a little bit about Gibeon here lately? This is the same place where they came down and put one over on Joshua and the Israelites, convincing them they had come from a far country. It's the same place we talked about last Sunday, where the confederation of five kings came and laid siege to Gibeon, and Joshua and the Israelites come up from Gilgal below and attack and drive them away. And so we learn here that Gibeon becomes the place where the tabernacle is erected for quite a while. We know it was at Shiloh for a while. It was at Nob for a while. Apparently here at Gibeon for a good while. Why would you have the tabernacle at Gibeon, do you think? What's that? Slave labor. You got free labor right there. That's where the Gibeonites are, and remember, they made them their slaves to be the carriers of the waters and the wood choppers. So they makes sense that you would locate it there where your labor supply is. But notice in verse 5, in Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give thee." Solomon said, "Thou hast showed unto thy servant David, my father, great mercy, according as he walked before thee in truth and in righteousness and uprightness of heart with thee. And thou hast kept for him this great kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a child. I know not how to go out or to come in." That figure of speech, going out and coming in, you'll find that running through the Bible. Even you remember Jesus talking about going out and finding pasture, in reference to him as a shepherd. And it's a figure of speech for how to conduct yourself, how to behave yourself. And so he's saying, "I'm a child. I don't know how to go in and come out. I don't know how to do this. In verse 8, "And thy servant is in the midst of thy people whom thou hast chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between the good and the bad." I said a moment ago that wisdom is the ability to discern the right course of action. What's right, what's just, what's proper. "For who is able to judge this thy great people?" And the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said unto him, "Because thou hast asked this thing," what is he asking for? Wisdom, understanding. "Because you ask this thing, and you have not asked for yourself long life, neither has asked riches for thyself, nor has asked for the life of thine enemies, but has asked for thyself understanding to discern judgment. Behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall arise any like unto thee. And I've also given thee that which thou hast not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee all thy days." So notice that God says, whatever you want. He's sort of like a genie out of a bottle here, you know. You got one wish. What do you want? And out of all the things Solomon could have asked, what does he ask for? Wisdom. To know how to conduct himself, how to do his job as king of Israel. And God says, because you didn't ask for all those other things, I'm going to give you all those other things and this too. So that is what, of course, we equate Solomon's reign with. It comes as a result of this reign. Now notice, immediately following, some of you probably already cheated, but without looking, tell me what the incident was that gained Solomon great renown for his wisdom. The two mothers. They have two babies. What are they? The two women are what? Huh? Prostitutes. Okay. In the night, one of them smothers the other's baby, or her baby, and she takes the other baby away from the other mother. And so they come to Solomon with this problem. And the problem is, how do we discern the real mother? Who's telling the truth? One of the mothers is saying, wait a minute, She smothered her baby and in the night stole my baby. And the other mother is saying, no, that's not true. It's her baby that got smothered. Now think about the difficulty of this. First of all, there are no witnesses. It's just the two women. They're the only ones who know the truth of the matter. Secondly, neither one of them are exact. It's not like these are character witnesses that you want to bring forward. They're not outstanding characters. They both are women of ill repute, to put it mildly. So how in the world do you figure that out? And you know the story. Solomon simply says, okay, bring me that baby. Cut him in two. We're going to solve this thing. We're going to just half him. Cut him in two, and I'll give half to you and half to you. And all of a sudden, one of the women went to say, oh, no, 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 don't give her the baby. Don't hurt the baby. And Solomon said, that's the mother. Now, after the fact, any of us here in this room could do the same thing, right? The problem is figuring this out before the fact. And notice that what do you have to know to do this, to make this judgment? What did you have to know? Human nature. All you really had to know was how mothers feel about their babies. And everybody knows how mothers feel about their babies. Everybody has the facts, but what determines wisdom is Solomon knew how to use that fact to discern who was the real mother. So it's one of those things that looking back, everybody says, oh, yeah, of course, that's how you would figure that out. But like I said, yeah, which of us would have done that before? We'd have sat there and scratched our head all day and finally thrown up our hands. Who can tell? Maybe we'd draw straws or whatever at the end of the day. So this is the incident that gets him renowned. I want you to look in 1 Kings chapter 4 at what is said about Solomon. Gives you some idea of the spectrum of his wisdom. In 1 Kings 4, verse 29, God gave Solomon wisdom and very much understanding and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. And he was wiser than all men. He gives you apparently a bunch of wise men here. Wiser than these. His fame was in all nations round about. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Can you think of one of Solomon's songs? Song of Solomon. It's the Song of Songs is how it's introduced. Of all the songs, this is the Song of Songs. But think about 1,005 songs. He spoke of trees, from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of fowl, of creeping things and of fish. And there came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So notice he was not just limited to one particular sphere. What would you sum this up? I mean, he knows music. He's a Renaissance man, a man for all seasons. I mean, this guy, well, whatever you want to talk about, he's an expert. Psalms, poems, you want to talk about literature, he's your guy. But if you want to talk about trees, a naturalist, you want to talk about botany, you want to talk about biology, here's your guy. So in other words, he is as well-rounded as it's possible to be for a man in his wisdom. And then notice the famous visit of the Queen of Sheba, all sorts of legends and stuff springing up about that. We don't know exactly where Sheba is. Most scholars believe it's where Yemen is today, down on the south end of the Saudi Peninsula. Others say it is Ethiopia, that she was actually a queen of Egypt. We just don't know. But you do recall her visit and her being astounded at his wisdom, saying she saw the glory and grandeur of his reign that the half had not been told her. Now, there are a few problems with the question of authorship. I just want you to notice back to Proverbs chapter 25 a moment. Proverbs 25, sort of an interesting verse here. Proverbs 25, verse 1 says, "These are also the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied out." All right, when did Solomon live? Give me a date. That's pretty close. Did you cheat, Barry? You just remembered that. Well, that's great. That makes me feel good. David lived about 1000 B.C. And if he lived then for 40 years, Solomon would begin to reign somewhere around 960 B.C. When did Hezekiah reign? Well, you're going the wrong way. It's time of the Assyrians, which, remember, was when? When did they carry away the northern kingdom? 721 B.C., they attacked the northern kingdom and carried it away. And then right around 700 B.C., they were besieging Lachish. Sennacherib sent his messenger up to Jerusalem, and Hezekiah was king. So roughly 700 B.C., so we're dealing with a time frame here of about 250 years after Solomon's day, that what we're being told is that though these are the Proverbs of Solomon, that they are being copied, they're sort of being appended to the end of what he originally wrote. And they're being appended by these scribes, apparently, that are scribes in the days of King Hezekiah. So in other words, it's not that they're not claiming that somebody else wrote these. They're Solomon's Proverbs, but they were not originally in the collection. And Hezekiah and his scribes have added them to the collection. So that's a rather just interesting thing. You don't normally find that in Scripture, the details of how the pieces of the Scripture got put together. And then the second thing is, at the very end of the book, you have two figures, and again, very mysterious figures. In Proverbs 30, verse 1, we have Agur, the Proverbs of Agur. And then in Proverbs 31, 1, we see the Proverbs of Lemuel. And anybody remember what follows in Proverbs 31? What is that about, that chapter? The virtuous woman. Remember, we read that at Mother's Day a lot. That falls in that section. Now, there are several schools of thought. We don't know who these, if these are kings, if they're wise men. The one theory is that they're Arabian kings, and this is some of their sayings, their writings. A lot of the Jewish scholars don't like that, because they don't like the idea of any Gentile writing Scripture, you see. The other school of thought that I think is probably more likely is that these two names, Agur and Lemuel, are again, and they do have, I can't recall right off the bat what the names mean in Hebrew or in Arabic, but they may just be pseudonyms for Solomon, much like Jedekiah. So you may just be talking about him under another name. We just don't know for sure. All right. Let's look at one final thing, the structure of the book. Notice, as we were to outline this, we've already read the first section. The first six verses form sort of a preface to the book of Proverbs. It tells us what's going to go on in here. It's all about gaining discretion, wisdom, understanding, that whole school of words. Then secondly, from chapter 1, verse 7, down to chapter 9, verse 18, we have a rather extended parable dealing with wisdom acting as a parent talking to a son. And that goes on for several chapters. It's very different from the rest of the book. And wisdom, anybody remember the Greek name for wisdom? Sophia. Sophia was the sort of a goddess, Greek goddess. So wisdom was typically thought of under a female figure. And that seems to follow sometimes in this parable. Other times it seems like it's the father, but it's basically a parent having a long talk with a son about the importance of gaining wisdom. That if you don't gain wisdom, doesn't matter what else you get, you're in trouble. All right? Then the next section is what we would just call classic Proverbs. Just a whole series. And notice we go all the way for 20 chapters of proverbial saying. Sometimes there is a connection between them. Other times it just seems like these are sort of random connections, random sayings. In other words, this is very different from other books, and that's why we're going to take it very differently. This we could be here for years trying to do this one at a time. And the other thing is that it's hard to find a theme. These things don't necessarily follow a theme. They just sort of come out of the blue, as we would expect from a collection of just wise sayings. And then finally, we have what I called here guest appendices. These two chapters at the end seem to be introducing these two, whether Solomon under another name or whether actually another wise king. We have this sort of appendix of these two chapters reporting to come from other sources. So that's the basic outline. We'll take a look at this first part next time.